Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, he's the legendary producer of landmark films like Platoon, JFK, and the new Joaquin Phoenix film Reservation Road, A. Kitman Ho. Plus, screenwriting guru Blake Snyder will drop by to tell us all about his new book, Save the Cat Goes to the Movies, the screenwriter's guide to every story ever told. Got a question for any of tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477 or log on to our chat room now. Dim the lights, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie and Jerry.
Welcome to another great episode of Movie Geeks United. We're very excited to be bringing you this show tonight, as always. I am one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and we have fellow movie geek Jerry here with us.
Hey, it's Jerry. How's everyone doing? I hope everyone's having a great Halloween.
Yeah, that's right. It's Halloween. You know, it seems like, maybe it's the same for you, if you don't have children, which I don't, I've yet to grow up in that sense. But it loses its luster. You know, it seems like you're so excited about Halloween when you're young, and it just kind of loses its luster as an adult.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, and to a certain degree, I mean, I do like we had a couple groups of kids come by much earlier. It's only 10 o'clock. I remember, like, years ago they used to come later, but now it's like we haven't had any trick-or-treaters for 2 hours now.
Yeah.
And it just seems like, I thought, because it seemed like we had a lot of little kids in the neighborhood, and I guess they come in, like, groups now.
You know what bothers me? That bothers me, when they bus them to different neighborhoods.
We don't even have that anymore. I remember those days,
you know,
being one of those kids who did that. But
strange neighborhoods that they're unfamiliar with. And maybe it's just a sign of the sad kind of times that we live in where, you know, nobody converses with their neighbors. Nobody, you know, everybody's very private and keep to themselves nowadays.
That's very true. Very true.
Yeah, but, you know, as you get older, all these special kind of landmark events during the years, you know, the things that you really cherished as a kid, everything, birthday, Halloween, all that kind of stuff, it kind of loses its luster for you as an adult.
Yeah, it does.
It's sad.
It is sad. God, you really want to start the show on a downer, but we haven't. Should we just go ahead and say what's really the elephant in the room?
We really should.
We really should.
We have big shows coming up. First, before we get to the big announcement, we have this Sunday, we have Mark Bosco. He's the author of a new book, The Independent Movie Marketing Handbook. It's the comprehensive how-to for filmmakers that have finished their movies, and they need to know how to market and distribute them, and he is a genius at that. And he'll be on the show Sunday to fill us in on that information.
And that'll be a good show for a lot of my friends to listen to.
Absolutely. You know, and tonight we're taking care of the screenplay stage.
We do the screenplay. We've been doing very well on that front.
This
one will only solidify that.
We have a huge guest tonight when it comes to screenplay instruction, because, you know, it's very rare that when people write these how-to screenwriting books, that they're actually working screenwriters.
I'm glad you said it, not me.
Yeah, this gentleman is absolutely one of our top working screenwriters, and he's written two books that are enormously fun reads, and informative and very entertaining. But he's so savvy about the screenwriting business and what it takes to structure a successful screenplay. And we're going to be speaking to him later on in this show. But November 11th, the following Sunday, we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of Poltergeist, a movie that I know, especially among our age group.
Oh, yeah.
It had a tremendous effect on us as kids watching that film.
Oh, yeah. I watched it I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it on videotape many times, and especially for the first Halloween when it came on VHS. I had to walk home from a party, and after watching that, I do remember that night very well.
Yeah. It's a great movie. And we have the writer and producer of Poltergeist 1 and Poltergeist 2. It's the same person, by the way.
Yeah.
he'll be Michael Grace, and he'll be joining us Sunday the 11th. Then on the 14th, and there's already some internet buzz about this, Wednesday the 14th, we have Oscar-nominated composer Mark Isham, who incidentally wrote the score to Reservation Road.
Yeah, very nice score, very good score. For
very good score, which we're anticipating Mr. A. Kit Mahoe to call in. What happened was he confirmed with us earlier this month, and I sent him an interview reminder a few days ago and have not heard back from him. I've sent him a couple. So hopefully he'll be calling in, but we definitely have Blake Snyder at the second half of the show if we're unable to speak to Mr. Ho this evening. Okay, so Mark Isham on the 14th, going to be a great guest. But here's the exciting stuff. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. I should have downloaded my uploaded my drum roll for this because.
Well, you did. Let's just go.
I'm trying to hold it out as long as possible.
I know.
This is true suspense here, people. November 7th on Wednesday, a week from tonight, we have one of our true cinematic idols. I think maybe top 2-3 favorite directors of all time.
Yeah.
Right at the top of the list. I mean, this is big for us. And talk about internet buzz.
Enormous.
Yeah, everyone is so excited. They're beyond speechless about this guest. Mr. Brian De Palma will be with us next Wednesday night, speaking about his new film, probably the most controversial film of his career.
That's true.
Yeah, Redacted, one of the most talked about, anticipated, discussed, debated films.
His critics are doing the ad work for him.
Really, yeah.
Bill O'Reilly has made this film what would have been a minor, not a minor release, but, you know, an art house film.
Yes.
Into a firestorm event. I mean, I would write, if I would write him a letter saying thank you, you know?
Absolutely. And it's just an incredible filmmaker. And, you know, the Iraq-themed movies are starting to come about now.
They are, yes.
This is the one everyone's talking about. This is the one that's stirring the most discussion and debate, which is probably its reason for being.
So yes.
I'm sure De Palma, on that end, is very pleased with.
I think that is the key right there. It's the closest thing that he has probably wanted to make his whole life, and especially in regards to Vietnam.
Right.
And the era that he came of age during. But he's taking, obviously, a lot of lessons from that and applied it to what's going on now. And he's made a film that he wants to be a lightning rod, and it seems that it's working.
Yes. So that we're beyond excited about it.
You're still kind of speechless and numb and shocked by the whole thing 24 hours later.
Yeah, definitely. And we have actually a two-hour show that evening. We're going to speak with Mr. De Palma for the first half hour of the show, and we're going to take another half hour to kind of recover and compose ourselves.
Yeah, keep it that way, okay? Don't go anywhere with that.
We're going to continue the discussion amongst ourselves after De Palma's segment, where we'll speak about Redacted, and we'll accept your phone calls, and you can join in on the conversation and share your thoughts on the interview and the film in general. And then at the top of the next hour, we're going to welcome Stuart Samuels. He is the director of the documentary Midnight Movies, From the Margins to the Mainstream. And that DVD is released in the next month, in November. And so we're very excited about speaking with him as well, because we've covered somewhat the subject, Midnight Movies, how they came to prominence in the 60s and the 70s through.
Well, I mean, really, if you think about it, I mean, with the David Lynch tribute and with this month with the horror films,
yeah,
we've definitely touched on that. We've given this this genre a very good look at.
Yeah, and we're talking, in the Lynch tribute, we spoke to Ben Barinholtz, who owned the theater, Elgin Theater, that ran El Topo and Eraserhead, and
right.
really started, propelled this Midnight movie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's going to be an exciting segment, an exciting discussion, a lot of fun that movie is. And then we'll welcome Keith Ulick, a good friend to the show, who actually participated in our Brian De Palma tribute earlier this year.
Yes, he did.
And we'll be talking about underrated classic films. He's going to come to us with what he considers to be three underrated cinematic treasures. And I always enjoy those conversations.
Yeah, I do. And I'll be very curious to hear what his three picks are. I mean, we can talk about them and be wonderful.
Yeah, it'll be a tremendously fun show, just like tonight. But there's something looming on the horizon in the film and television industry. Right?
Yeah, it's big. It has the potential to be shattering.
Yeah, it is an impending writer's strike. Now, I'm sure that most people out there have read headlines here and there throughout the net on this writer's strike, and maybe heard some sound bites on TV devoted to it. But it has pretty far-reaching consequences if this thing comes to pass, which by all accounts it looks to be doing.
Sometime at the earliest, at least I've heard, the latest I've heard is sometime next week if the talks like tomorrow and over the weekend don't go well.
Right. And so it's perfect that we have such a high-profile screenwriter with us this evening.
Yes.
So we can carry on a conversation with him, a brief conversation about it, because I definitely want to devote most of the time to his extraordinary books.
Right.
But since we have some moments here before we welcome Mr. Snyder on the show, let's give people a sense of what this writer's strike is, what's inspiring it, and what it can mean.
Well, it seems like, and I'll go just tell you the conversations I've been having with people, the thing is the new media, the internet. There's people, we live in an era with new technology, and the writers justly, and this will go the same for the actors later on, would like the residual. I take it this is about residuals. It's like with syndication.
Right.
It's the residuals. And, you know, the writers feel they are owned something, and justly they are.
Truthfully, this is something that... you know, we talk about theatrical exhibition being kind of losing money.
Yeah, we talked about that. We actually had a very good show where just the three of us talked about that about 2 months ago.
Yeah, the dollars might be going up, but that's misleading because the attendance is going down. And that
big
means
time.
The ticket prices are rising to compensate for that.
Right.
Fewer people are going to the movies, essentially, is what this comes down to. More people are staying in the comfort of their own homes. You know, this whole home entertainment movement, the HDTVs and the Blu-ray discs and the whole
right.
theater systems are becoming part of the norm now, and it's really affecting theatrical exhibition.
It is.
DVDs are, you know, years ago they started outgrossing the theatrical dollars. Now we have a whole different realm of media. We have downloadable web movies that they're offering. We have
right.
iPhones. We have all kinds of stuff that hasn't been taken into account in the contracts with the Writers Guild. So they're wanting their share of profits from those revenues, and we're all for them getting it, but they're very stringent they're not being very cooperative.
No, that's one way to look at it. Actually, before we go, I would just like to touch on something we didn't touch on.
Yeah.
And you can cut me off at any time. Or there was a story at the beginning of October, the Heartbreak Kid came out, the remake with Ben Stiller, the Farley Brothers remake. And, you know, they were expecting this movie to do very well. I mean, really well, and it didn't. It was a disappointment. And the initial thing that came out was the studios actually came up with it, and I don't know how true this is, but that because Halo 3 was released, the video game,
yeah.
everyone was staying, the target audience was staying home playing the video game instead of going to the movies. Did you hear about this?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think this is true? Because I just thought, how about the movie just wasn't very good?
It wasn't very good.
It was pretty mediocre at best.
But usually there'll be an anticipation And they'll see it on the first weekend, and then they'll find out that it's no good, and then they'll not come back.
They didn't bother going.
They didn't bother going in the first place. I think the Halo thing might have relevance here.
Oh, it does. It has. It's that, you know, you would want to make that, was it $170 million in 3 days?
Right.
I can't think of a movie studio that doesn't want to make that kind of money with a film
in
3 days. But I just, like, as someone, one of the columnists pointed out, did anyone just consider the movies just not very good instead of...
True.
Yeah.
That is true. And there was another article today that people aren't going to the movies to even see good films. I mean, they're not supporting In the Valley of Elah, and they're not supporting...
There is another reason for that. And as someone... This is the... Did I read this in last week's Variety or this week's Variety? But he said, look, with all these, they made a mistake. The studios released too many serious movies in a small window.
Right.
And the guy said, well, some of these are actually very good movies. Said, with the people with their free time are just not going to go see a movie like Rendition.
Mm.
It's not going to happen. They're not going to go see even something that was well received on the Halle Berry movie, which did get good reviews, but just it was too many R-rated adult themed movies for one weekend.
Right.
And in your
they might as well have called it Things We Lost at the Box Office.
Absolutely. And this is actually another thing. I don't know whether this is because they're worried about the looming strike. The last couple months we've had, and we're going to have this till Christmas, many big movies are going to be competing for a very small piece of the pie every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I don't know how they think they can win. I mean, there are going to be a lot of losers.
Yeah.
And this past weekend, I guess not this past, but the weekend before, was the most movies ever released for one weekend.
Mm.
And it was a record. Right? And, you know, just you're... It's like with having the super chain bookstores. You have so many, but you're competing for such a small audience. And I think it's just the same thing is becoming true with movies now.
Yeah, this goes back to an essay that I wrote many months ago. You know, it's these quality movies.
It was a great essay.
Yeah, come out. But time and time again, it's the lowest common denominator films that make it number one. Make it to number one, $35 million. And meanwhile, films like Michael Clayton come and go in a snap of the finger. And that, I think this is what, so it'll be interesting to speak to Mr. De Palma next week, because I think this probably worries him too, and I think it's a direct parallel to his point that during the Vietnam era, we became invested in that war. We had the images come to us in our television sets, you know, all the unedited graphic imagery of what war means.
Right.
Now we don't. Now our eyes are closed to it. Now we don't want to have that on our TVs. We want to kind of shut our eyes to it. I think the same thing goes for movie-going habits.
Very true.
More and more, people don't want to be challenged. People don't want to think. They don't want to be stimulated. They do, but only in a theme park ride sense.
Right. You're absolutely right, Jamie. And I think here, I guess I'm kind of the anomaly because I want, of course, you know, I like escapism. I'm at the end of the week. Of course, I want to see something fun. But I also, I guess I'm this paradox, because I do want to see the engaging social commentary, political film as well.
Right.
And I want to go. I'm going to go out of my way if I have time to go see something like No End in Sight or The 11th Hour, or especially In the Valley of Elah, because these things do, I think, and as our guest next week will say, this is how you make a statement. These are the tools. This is the media, how you make a statement.
Yeah, that's true. We have a call from a 310 area code, and I don't believe this is either of our guests planned for this evening. So let me pick it up real quick. 310 area code, go right ahead. 310, are you with us?
Hello?
Yes, 310?
No, I don't think they're there, Jamie.
Okay. I know that Mr. Snyder is calling in at 30 minutes past the hour, and now they're gone.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that was A. Kitman Ho or not, because I could not confirm a phone number with him. But hopefully it was not.
Yeah, okay, no, hopefully it was not. But okay, but let's go. I think maybe what we should do, I think we should talk about if there is a strike, what would be the first casualties?
Well, I've from my understanding, the first, the most immediate casualty will be the late night programs. Particularly, you know, David Letterman. You know, 20 years ago, 1988, not quite 20 years ago, we did have a strike, and it lasted just shy of 6 months. It cost the industry $500 million, which today, if we had a strike like that, it would be upwards of $1 billion.
Wow.
And the most immediately affected were the television. David Letterman went dark because he supported his writers, and so they just went with reruns, I believe. And what you'll see now, if this happens, production on all of these television shows will cease. That means that all these shows that are returning are currently maybe halfway through shooting, say 24, or like you said, Lost.
Lost is a big, they say, will be hurt really badly by this.
Yeah, these seasons aren't entirely written yet. So that means that whatever of these seasons are they're able to salvage, they're gonna show up in kind of truncated form without an ending. I mean, that's my impression.
That's what I've been reading too, and I think also now, like as you said, Letterman did not, he honored his writers. I would imagine that everyone's gonna, I'd like to think everyone would follow that lead, like Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, and Jimmy Kimmel. All these guys are gonna have to stop.
Well, the truth be known, I mean, each of these shows have a large staff of writers.
That's right.
So, I mean, the show can't help but suffer or stop altogether as
right.
a result of losing them. It's interesting. So this could be very catastrophic. Meanwhile, the studios have been stockpiling scripts. They've seen the signs of this for months and months now. And you notice they're signing a lot of people very quickly.
They're signing people. They're rushing things into production. And
Saw
this,
5 and 6, they just signed a Spider-Man 4 writer. And,
there is one casualty, maybe, though, of the Transformers 2. And
yeah.
I know Royce Clemens is probably excited to know that if the strike happens, Transformers 2 will not happen. But
right. I wasn't looking forward to Transformers 2. Let me rephrase that. I actually enjoyed Transformers.
I did. I enjoyed it, too. I know that we're... it's not cool to say that, but I had a great time.
Yeah, you know, and here I am. I just got through with my big
heart-pounding You just got through
speech.
That big speech, and you just blew it.
Oh, man. So the writer's strike could be very perilous for the industry, and a lot of money riding on it. Really.
Oh, there's a lot. But what boggles me, though, and we talked about this earlier, is that the executives and the studio heads welcome it.
Yeah.
They believe that this fall TV season has been disastrous for them. They would like to basically start over from scratch. And I find this, I mean, that's a lot of to say that. And you do have some success stories out there.
Well, you have a lot of good shows, too, that just aren't doing well.
Yeah.
That's another thing. You'll be seeing, if it's even imaginable, you'll be seeing more reality programming.
There's going to be a ton. I guess Fox will make out more than anyone.
Yeah, because, you know, reality programming, they could, game shows and such, they could do without the script writers.
Yeah.
So God help us all.
Yes, it's not going to be a fun time. Reading is going to come back.
You know, that would be a blessing. That would be very nice.
That would be. And you can get caught up on all the movies that like you have on DVD or that you recorded on your TiVo or shows that you haven't gotten a chance to watch.
Yes. Start recording every program on television on your TiVo.
Yes.
The television landscape is going to look a little bleaker come when this writer strike comes into effect. You know, you mentioned Heartbreak Kid. And talk about a screenplay that was hurting.
Yeah.
Did you see Heartbreak Kid?
I did see it.
Yeah, I just got a chance to. I my girlfriend was just begging me to take her. So I took her, and it's I know what they wanted to do. They wanted to bring back they wanted to show that they're still relevant, that they're still into that shocking R-rated, that there's something about Mary feel.
Yeah, and they just couldn't do it.
Because there's something about Mary started this whole trend of the gross-out comedy.
Right.
It was the monster that they created, and it's outrun them.
Yeah, it has. And I have not seen the original with Charles Grodin. From what I understand, that it's somewhat different. And
yes,
actually, it was my mom who said, I never thought I'd say this, but I actually thought Charles Grodin wasn't as annoying now, come to think of it, watching the Ben Stiller. And she was quite shocked by that.
I love Charles Grodin.
Oh, Charles, no, he's actually, and I love him, obviously, in Midnight Run.
Yes.
Is a favorite performance of mine.
I have a favorite little moment in Midnight Run.
Oh, which is it?
I ever tell you about it? It's a part that I find these little moments in these films that I find such great pleasure during, and nobody else. It just
shoot, tell us.
It's when they have the car chase with the helicopter.
Right, right.
Looming up there, and they crash into a ditch.
Oh yeah.
Near a creek, and De Niro helps Charles Grodin out of the car, and says, "Are you all right?" And Charles Grodin says, "Oh yeah, I'm enjoying it."
Yeah.
A little passing moment.
Yeah.
Just that sarcasm that no one does as well.
No, he doesn't. He used to have. And I actually did watch it when it was on that show he had on CNBC in the 90s.
Right.
I actually enjoyed that. I would like to see him do something like that again.
He's very dry sense of humor.
Yeah.
Very much so. Okay. I'm not sure if this is... just got a message from A. Kidman Ho. I don't know if he says, "Sorry, on the phone waiting. I'm late. We have an interview segment with another guest scheduled at 10:30. But if this is Mr. Ho, let's bring him on and let's speak to him for as long as we possibly can, because it's a great honor for us to speak with him."
Yes,
tonight.
It is.
We're honored this evening to speak to one of our most accomplished and influential producers, whose roster of unforgettable films never fail to stir emotions, provoke thought, and inspire discussion. He worked as a production manager on classic films like Reds and My Favorite Year before embarking on his producing career in the 80s, quickly striking up a fruitful relationship with legendary director Oliver Stone, eventually bringing to the screen timeless films like Platoon, Wall Street, Born on the 4th of July, and JFK. Additional producing credits that grace his remarkable resume include The Ghost in the Darkness, Ali, Hotel Rwanda, and the new drama starring Joaquin Phoenix, Jennifer Connelly, and Mark Ruffalo called Reservation Road. It is a great pleasure to welcome to our program two-time Oscar nominee, Mr. A. Kidman Ho. Mr. Ho, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm right here. I'm sorry I'm late. I got stuck in traffic and I was on the phone, so I apologize.
Oh, no, that's fine. Thank you so much for giving us a call this evening.
Yes, thank you.
Pleasure.
It's a great honor to speak with you. Now,
who is who?
I'm sorry, my name is Jamie.
And I'm Jerry.
And who's the other gentleman? I'm sorry?
Jerry.
Gary, okay.
Jerry.
Jerry, okay, I'm sorry, I got
that's
it.
That's all right.
Nice meeting you guys.
I wanted to get a sense of how you got started in the business. I know that you were born in Hong Kong, and you moved to New York City at a young age. But when exactly did you know that movies were your passion?
I think I went to I grew up in New York, obviously, and I went to see a Japanese movie called Rodan.
Uh huh.
And that was the first time I've ever actually seen a movie in a movie theater.
Oh, what a great movie to start with!
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Those are like my guilty pleasures. So
yeah.
Not even guilty pleasures, just childhood favorites. I love those.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's the day the earth stood still, and and then there is Battle of Algiers.
Wonderful!
And of course, there's Z. I mean, those are the films that sort of, they entertain. I mean, I love the day the earth stood still because it has a great moral to the story, besides being entertaining, which I think is really lacking in today's cinema. Then, we try to do that, but then it's a hard thing to a bridge to bridge,
right?
To doing both of those things, and people tend to you either get the blockbusters or you get the Reservation Roads, and you try to do a picture in between. It's tough stuff.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you mention those films as initial influences, because I see so much of that in the work that you produce. films that are, first of all, incredibly entertaining and engrossing, but have a moral message, and they're actually about something, you know, and that's so rare in today's cinematic landscape to see movies that are actually about something significant.
Right.
But you've worked under some terrific filmmakers early on in your career, and producers like Warren Beatty and Dino De Laurentiis. And,
yeah, those were great people.
What kind of lessons did you take from them that helped to guide you as you embarked on your producing career?
Well, I mean, I mean, Dino is one of the greatest because he's like a pirate.
Yeah.
And he's always been a pirate. And and what's great about Dino is that you never, you know, it's like he's an old gentleman from Italy. He brings his barber with him everywhere, cuts his hair. You know, he has his chef. He's like a unique character that we don't get those people these days, you know. And that's what the great thing about him. And the thing about it is that he just say, I'm going to do this, and he do it. And I think that's the same thing, you know, with Warren. And in the old days, the film business is not as big as today, you know, where it's a giant conglomerate business.
Mm-hmm.
And so the being an independent, a true independent, is possible. I don't know if there's such a thing as a true independent today.
Yeah,
because you really actually need those giant corporations to release your films, and you know, to deal with all of that, and you know, I mean, when we did Reds, Warren just actually said, you know, he knows Charlie Blohan, and that's the reason he did it. You know, he said, I can do it, and he went and did it. So I thought it was great, and it was a passion project for him, and
yeah.
I just find that to be a. You know, that's inspirational, and doing films like that, you go out and you see other films, you say, because, you know, for me, especially somebody who's been, you know, doing this for a while, it's like, it's 2 years of my life, you know, and my theory is that, like, it's either for the money or you're going to spend 2 years of life doing something that doesn't get you anything.
Yeah.
Right.
You mentioned how much the business has kind of changed. What has changed for you concerning the role of the producer? Has that changed at all since?
Well, you know, I mean, I started as a PA, so you know,
yeah.
I mean, so being doing what I do is that I developed the project. I started from the beginning to end. But the fact is that, you know, there didn't used to be line producers. They used to be production managers, there are producers and there's studio people, and you know, and then they actually, and the job has gotten so. You know, like making a movie has gotten so horizontal,
yeah,
instead of a vertical, and you know, so doing independent films, you're basically, you know, dealing with less people, and you actually are involved in the film and a lot more, and so it's also like when you spend $200 million, you need an army just to account for it.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you start dealing with that, you know, so that you can't really blame it to get to more formulistic because, you know, you really need something to protect the entity who actually putting up the money.
Excellent.
And you know, so the risk is higher, and there's also, I mean, the financial landscape changes all the time. Now there is a wash with silly money. There's always silly money running around the film business, and each time it's different silly money.
Right, right.
You know, so
I just wanted to say to our listeners out there and to our second guest for the evening, Mr. Blake Snyder, who's holding, it'll just be a few minutes. We're just running a little bit behind this evening, but we'll bring on Mr. Snyder in just a few minutes. We're speaking right now to legendary producer A. Kitman Ho. And I wanted to talk to you about your work with Oliver Stone, which ran from Platoon to Heaven and Earth, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, and I developed Salvador with him together.
Oh, great.
How did it,
except that I ran out of money. I can't afford to do the picture for no money. I had a TV movie.
Yeah. How did you come to meet him and begin working with him?
I was working with Dino. Mr. De Laurentiis on a project. Since I grew up in New York, I wanted to do a picture on the Chinatown gang, and
right.
We went to a number of writers. And then Dino bought this project called Year of the Dragon, And then Dino got Michael Cimino to direct the movie.
Yeah.
And then from Michael Cimino, we got Oliver Stone to write the screenplay, and Oliver was going to write the screenplay for Half Price, and Dino was going to produce Platoon.
Mm.
But none of the, you know, the second part didn't happen. And so I went with Oliver and Cimino around town and for about 6 months and developed the screenplay, and that's how I met Oliver. And from then on, we did Picture of the Year because I love working with him. He's a genius as a writer and a great director.
He is one of the legends, no doubt about it. And he's made, I have to ask you about two films in particular, because they're two films that I think absolutely rank among the finest American films ever. And they have really changed my life in a way.
Really? Wow.
And that's Born on the Fourth and JFK.
Wow.
Can you share any of the first memories that come to your mind about both of those productions?
Well, I mean, I remember that Oliver read the book, JFK, which is the Jim's story.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jim Garrison, right?
Jim Garrison's story, and that was great. And we were doing, what were we doing? We were doing Wall Street, that's what it was. And then we were doing Wall Street, and then we were talking about it, and then we decided that we should, and then Tom, we went, and he had the same agent as Tom Cruise, which is Paul Wagner at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Tom was interested, so we had to wait for Tom, and we did that picture. Yeah, we did that picture. What did we do it for? Born on the Fourth. I forgot who we did Born on the Fourth for.
Universal.
Oh, Universal, right? We did that. Universal, right? Oh yeah, and then but we had to wait for him. So that's why we did Talk Radio in Dallas, because we couldn't afford to shoot it in New York, so we shoot it in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
We did two pictures. We squeezed at it, and it was the second part of Oliver's trilogy, because I think that those were great pictures because it's really Oliver and it's really something he needs to get out of his system.
Yeah,
and it's something that I think is very important. And
and it seems, in terms of both of these films, it seems like passion just seeps out of every frame. Like just
oh,
like
absolutely.
You said, like he had to make these.
Exactly.
They're so incredibly personal to him.
Yeah, it is, and that's what Platoon was too. Platoon was something that he really was really part of his life, and he actually lived through that. And talking to him about it.
Yeah, but in terms of JFK, would you say that that is the most challenging production that you've ever been involved in?
No, that isn't the most challenging. That was the most, it's very rewarding,
yeah.
And it is, I think, most interesting, I would say, because because we use a lot of formats, totally a lot of different formats in film, and also then telling that story, because it could be a very boringly straight story.
Right.
And being that that the story right now it is a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What
really strikes me about it is, first of all, I like I said, I think it's one of the great American films, but it was shot in 72 days, I read, and that same year you guys did The Doors.
Yeah.
So it was like a back-to-back that just staggering.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the great thing about it is that at that time, we basically built a team of people,
uh-huh.
Like the cinematographer, which is Bob Richardson, and the designers, and so on. We had all these people, and all the people would go from one film to the other. So by the time we're in editorial, we have two editors who obviously that we work together a lot, and they they most of them won Academy Awards. That's
yeah.
How lucky they were. And so the teams just keep on going. So by the time, like, Oliver would write the structure of the thing, the movie, I would be scouting it, and then the team would go in and knowing exactly what we need, and we go from there and there. So that makes it easy, very easy for him to, as a team, like, I understand what he needed, and
uh-huh.
and I basically prep it, and then the DP knows what he needed, the designer. So it was great communication. It was really actually making movies.
Yeah.
It was actually a group that's actually making movies. We made it really fun.
Yeah.
And all good things come to an end.
Before I let you go, I'm so sorry we're rushed tonight. I have to ask you about Reservation Road. Is this your second film with Terry George after Hotel Rwanda?
Yes. This is the second film.
What is it? Tell me what about this material spoke to you and made you want to bring it to the screen.
I think, you know, the book was not like the best of the books I read, but I think I obviously is wrong because it didn't do that well in today's box office because nobody knows anything much about it. But the point is that I see it as America today, where anything happened, you always blame somebody else.
Yeah.
And you would destroy the family or whatever it is to go from one place to the other so that you can get satisfaction. And I think that's the underlining feeling that I see in this, in the story. And I was hoping to, you know, have that come out as an interesting, but I don't think we succeeded very well, or we didn't sell the film very well, one or the other.
Yeah.
But I think that in making the film, I felt that we accomplished what we, you know, wanted to do.
We're speaking about that earlier, actually, before you came on. And that's why I made sure to point out to you that your career impresses me to no end, because your films are about something. It seems that the movies that are the most popular nowadays aren't necessarily ones that are concerned with ideas, or if you know what I'm trying to say.
I totally agree. I think that, you know, it's like when I actually went out and pitched Platoon to everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody said great script, we loved it, and they said we don't know anybody's ready for it. And I think that certain subjects, because we're in a war, and the way America is so divided, I don't think anybody, you know, it's the situation at the time that people are not into hearing about subjects like that.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and I would think that, you know, that's really, you know, where the problem probably lies these days. And, you know, it's all a matter of, I think a lot of time you get lucky if it's receptive.
Yeah. You
know, because it's the right time for people to really to deal with this subject. And if they're not, then they're not, you know. So, and I think that's one of the reasons. Like, I think, for example, all the war movies died in the box office, you know. I mean,
that's very true.
You know, and I think it's too early. I think 10 years later, maybe, you know, people are receptive. It's very much of the timing of what, you know, of what people are, you know, where they are.
It is in the timing, yeah.
Yeah. That's my, you know, two cents, because, but, you know. But, you know, you have to do what you have to do.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Ho, thank you so much for calling in tonight. We have so many more questions for you, but can you come back to us at a later date? Can we work out something?
Yeah, I'd love to do that.
We would love to have you.
Send me an email, and Jerry and Jamie, and we'd love to talk again, because, you know, this is...
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With people who cares.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Keep making movies that matter.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. That's producer A. Kitman Ho. I'm sad we weren't able to spend.
I know. I mean, fascinating stories. Lots of fascinating stories.
We just crammed a half hour interview.
You did an excellent job. But before we, if I could just say one thing before we.
Yes. Now, next guest is on the line, and we're just about to get to him. Go ahead.
Now, I just, you know, he said something. It's too soon with the Iraq War movies, and the sad thing is, I don't even know if we'll ever get there, because I don't know how long we're going to be there, you know? When
yeah,
do you even
I mean,
start?
And Oliver Stone realizes that now. That's why he's making Pinkville, trying to draw the parallels between today and the Vietnam era.
Right.
It'll be interesting to speak to Brian De Palma on next Wednesday's show.
That's right. Well, let's get to Mr. Snyder.
That's it. Okay. Blake Snyder is with us tonight, and he's been so kind holding on the phone for us. He is a highly accomplished screenwriter who's made millions writing films for giants like Disney and Steven Spielberg. Widely known as one of Hollywood's most successful spec screenwriters, Mr. Snyder first committed his years of hard-earned expertise to the pages of his 2005 book, Save the Cat, the last book on screenwriting you'll ever need. Six printings later, that book has become the primary teaching tool at some of the most prestigious university screenwriting programs in the country. This month, Mr. Snyder delivers a sequel of sorts that's every bit as entertaining, enlightening, and engaging as his last effort. And Save the Cat goes to the movies, the screenwriter's guide to every story ever told. Mr. Snyder outlines a variety of genre types and applies his foolproof structural breakdowns to 50 classic films from the last 30 years. Mr. Snyder himself describes the book as a universal key to unlock every successful movie ever made. And boy, does he deliver on that promise. This incredibly fun and insightful book will deepen everyone's appreciation and understanding of great cinematic storytelling, from the newbie screenwriter to the most enthusiastic film fan. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Blake Snyder. Mr. Snyder, are you with us?
Jamie, thank you very much. Yes, I'm here.
All right, wonderful.
I'm so sorry you had a hold like that. It was an unforeseen delay in the show here, but thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Sure, I was really enjoying listening to the previous guest. What a great story, a lot of stories he had to tell, and I share with you. I love some of those films that he was mentioning.
Oh yeah,
What a great career.
Yes.
So much. So, something to really be proud of. But
yeah.
Speaking of being proud of something, your book is fantastic. I adored it. It's written very in a very conversational, fun yet informative tone. I loved it, and I just want to share with you. I was watching Alien, the original Alien, on cable with my girlfriend the other day. She hadn't seen it, and I shouted out, "Oh, that's a MITH. That's a Monster in the House." And she had no idea what I was talking about. So we'll fill her in during this interview. But first of all, tell me a little bit about your background. Tell me how your career started.
Well, I'm third generation, actually, of film business. My father's uncle was an RKO publicist. Mm. My dad was a producer. He a children's TV producer for shows like Roger Ramjet. I don't know if you know that show. Cartoon in the 60s is sort of a cult classic.
Yeah.
And a show called Big Blue Marble in the 70s.
Big Blue Marble, I remember.
Oh, cool.
I remember watching that like every Saturday, I believe, on NBC.
Yeah, it was a nice show about kids around the world. It was an Emmy Award winning show, and so I grew up in the business. I mean, I did grow up in the business and learned a lot of valuable lessons from my dad. I got my SAG card doing voices for his cartoons when I was eight. So I learned about the business a lot from him, including sort of the, you know, the ups and downs of it, as your previous guest was speaking of. There's this intersection between, you know, art and commerce, and
mm-hmm.
You know, some of your best creative ideas, you know, take the longest to get made, and you know, having a little bit of patience was a good lesson too. And then when I got out of school, I went immediately. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to write screenplays, and I started writing on spec, as it's called. So got very lucky, sold a lot of scripts over the course of my career. I sold one to Steven Spielberg for called Nuclear Family.
Mm.
And it was, you know, talk about a couple of great conversations. I sat across the table from, you know, Steven Spielberg as he talked about his love of movies. And, you know, the lesson I got from him was he loved what he was doing, and he could name every movie, name what people were wearing in certain times, you know. And
that you can feel that enthusiasm in every one of his movies too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about your show, and I love about this pursuit, which is I love storytelling. I love storytelling. Love movies, and I love finding, you know, patterns.
Mm-hmm.
In what makes a good story. So
let's talk about your storytelling techniques and some of those patterns as you've described them in your books. First of all, save the cat. That expression. What does that concept of save the cat mean?
Well, there have been a lot of really good screenwriting books out there, and I've learned from the masters. You know, Sid Field was, when I was coming up, it was the book that everyone read, his book called Screenplay, which is just the classic, and also from Robert McKee, lots and lots of people, you know, I've learned from the best, but even, you know, the ones that are out there seemed to me to be academic,
right,
and what I had never seen really was sort of an inside baseball screenwriting book that sort of talks the way me and my screenwriter pals talk. And that's where Save the Cat came from. Save the Cat is just, you know, me and my buddies hanging around Jerry's Deli and after the meeting at the studio saying, you know, trying to fix a certain script. And, you know, where's the Save the Cat scene? The Save the Cat scene is when we meet the hero of a movie for the first time. And the hero does something nice, like, you know, save a cat.
Mm-hmm.
It
right.
makes us like him. It makes us want to go along with him. And it's a key element in getting the story going right. You know, many times we hear a variation of that note from the studio people saying, you know, why, I don't like this guy. I don't like this hero. Why don't I like this hero? And very often we had failed to put in that scene.
That moment of redemption.
Well, yeah, where we go, oh, this is an okay guy. I want to see where, I want to root for him.
Right.
Right.
The classic example is, you know, Al Pacino in a movie called Sea of Love. He's a cop.
You've mentioned my idol there.
Yeah, I mean, you just sealed the deal. I mean.
Oh, good. Yeah, he's terrific. And that movie in particular was sort of a comeback vehicle for him at the time, believe it
yeah.
or not. I mean, and everything had to be right. And part of that was liking the character he played. And right up front, Sea of Love, he's a cop, and they have a sting operation where they bring, you know, outstanding warrants in by pretending that they're going to have breakfast with the Yankees. Well, they bust all the guys, and then here comes this one guy late to the sting operation, and
mm-hmm.
he's brought his kid with him. Well, Al Pacino sees this father with his son. The dad just wants his kid to meet the Yankees. And, you know, he checks the warrants, makes sure this guy isn't like a major felon, and then he says, you know, take a walk. We're going to let you go. Flashes his badge. The guy realizes the favor he just got.
Right.
And walks away. And, you know, the great line going out was, you know, Al Pacino says, catch you later.
Absolutely.
He's not a total fool. but we like him. And I don't know about you, but I'm going with this guy now.
Absolutely.
I like this guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the only reason for that scene, and that's the Save the Cat scene. It's
yeah. So your first book, Save the Cat, the last book on screenwriting you'll ever need. What motivated you to write a sequel to the last book on screenwriting?
I got sort of I thought really that this I had said everything I wanted to say in the first book and writing that really came out of, you know, writers asking me advice, and I kind of wrote it all out in a form that I thought was easy to read,
mm-hmm.
And yet there was still some unfinished business. The second book really gets more into genre, and as you mentioned a little bit earlier, Monster in the House is sort of my slangy term for a type of movie that we all know. And, you know, I have 10 of those different genres. Well, I mentioned them in the first book. I sort of, in passing, sort of talked about what I thought were the 10 types of movies Hollywood makes and audiences like.
Yeah.
And then I realized, you know, we really have to go further here and explain this. So the last 2 years have really been a wonderful journey for me. I've watched, you know, hundreds of films to pick the 50 that I thought were best examples of what
yeah.
the different genres were. And I learned so much. I got to say, there were moments where I'd be watching a set of films and go, oh, I can't believe there's this character that appears in every one.
Uh-huh.
And you know, for a screenwriter, it's not just about, you know, I don't want to copy, but I want to know the essence. I want to know what makes these stories work.
Well, if you could kind of illustrate for our listeners, when you're talking about the similarities between these movies as represented in these different genres, let's take The Monster in the House. I think this first dawned on you. You had a conversation where someone said to you that I think it was Jaws and Alien are the same movie. Was that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I was a young writer, 20-year-old guy, and this was my initiation into storytelling. My friend Jim Hagen, we would go on to write that script that we sold to Nuclear Family, but at the time we were just young writers. And he said that to me. Did you know that Alien and Jaws are the same movie? Well, to me, this was mind-blowing. You know, one movie is about a shark, you know, run amok on the beaches of Amity. The other is about, you know, a space monster, spaceship. How are these two movies similar? Well, he went on to point out the similarities. We called it a monster in the house movie, and
mm-hmm.
they have three important characteristics. There is a monster, you know, intent on eating the cast. There is an enclosed space into which this monster is let loose, and the most important element of this was there's a sin. Sin of greed is what lets the monster loose in Amity. It's the same sin that lets the monster loose on the spaceship Nostromo in Alien. And uncovering that societal sin is sort of the transformational thing that happens in these stories. Well, Monster House Sin, you see the story goes all the way back to the Minotaur and the Maze.
Mm.
Great monster, half man, half bull. Great house.
Yeah.
This scary maze. And the sin in that story is incest, societal incest.
Yeah.
You keep seeing this movie again and again. Saw, you know, you can think of the house that Carrie always is enclosed in. You can think of The Shining, a haunted house movie. Monster, house, sin, monster, house, sin. It just keeps repeating again and again. And, you know, our job as screenwriters, our job as storytellers is to make it fresh. You take these elements. That, you know, if you thought The Minotaur and the Maze was the last horror movie you'd ever need to watch, you haven't seen Bruce the Shark yet. You know?
Absolutely, and you really have a way. There are 10 genre types that you have in this book, with five cinematic examples for each one. You really have a way of expressing the essence of each of these films just beautifully.
Oh, thank you very much.
And I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned this in your book and just now as well, that you address the need for people to feel like they're being original. And you say there's no such thing, there's only varying degrees of a fresh take on it.
Right.
And I thought that was very interesting. So why shouldn't the fledgling screenwriter out there be depressed by the idea that there are no more original ideas?
Well, you know, and you're right. Many people will hear this and say either they don't believe it, which is common. I get that a lot. Or, yes, they're depressed by that. And to me, this is just, again, sort of my years of being a screenwriter. You know, you start with the cliche, and then you come up with the topper. You came up with the thing that's new.
Uh-huh.
But that is the job of storytelling, and has been the job of storytelling forever. You know, as I say, you know, we're not all just ripping off Jaws. We're trying to come up with the new way to tell a scary story, finding a new way of dealing with sin and guilt in the case of a Monster in the House movie. You know, how does that change as time goes on, as society changes? Is there sin now? You know, you were mentioning the Iraq War, and I think part of what makes the Japanese horror films work, where there doesn't seem to be a sin, is sort of the sin of ignorance. You know, in The Grudge, what does she really do wrong? You know, nothing.
Right.
But I think what that sort of speaks to is we can go shopping at the mall and we can go buy some jeans at the Gap, and meanwhile, in Iraq, you know, I think the sin of ignorance is sort of what's common about these latest batch of horror movies, which is, you know, I've called the nihilist monster. You know,
that's a good, very good point.
Do you mind if we take a phone call real quick?
Sure,
And then I just have a few more questions to ask you. But
okay.
We have a phone caller here from an 850 area code. 850, go right ahead.
Hey, how you doing? This is Anthony, just listening into your program on this happy Halloween.
Thank you, Anthony. Happy Halloween to you.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Yes, and you know, it's all, you know, you're talking about scary movies. So, you know, I wanted to hear your show again, so I had to listen in, and I knew the archive was going to get, you know, it only lasts for an hour, so I had to call in and just listen to the whole thing.
Well, thank you so much. Did you have you tried your hand at screenwriting at all? Did you have any questions related to screenwriting at all?
No, I'm just a fan, really. I'm a fan of film, and, you know, that's about it. I'm a fan of film. I went to school with the Wachowski brothers, and and some other directors out there in Hollywood, and yeah, I just kind of find it interesting, you know, that people are able to, you know, express their life in their in a way where it affects society on a massive scale like that, and it just piqued my interest over the last few months that ability exists, and that's about it. And so I've just kind of been listening, getting my geek on.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony. Thanks for calling in tonight, and thanks for listening.
No problem.
Bye-bye. I like Anthony's point about having something to say and having movies be the place to say them. I mean,
yeah,
that is, you know, if it was the 18th century, we'd all be writing novels, but it isn't. We're all writing screenplays,
mm-hmm.
and that's how we communicate with each other. I think also the documentary form is, you know, booming and fascinating. But even there, we follow a story template, and you know, I have a thing in my book about, you know, all stories are about transformation. There's something that starts off at the beginning, and by the end, it's completely different. You know, what happened? You know, that is what a good story is. And whether it's a documentary or an independent film or a, you know, big Hollywood studio movie, these principles are what we respond to. And I have to say, it gives me chills to talk about storytelling. It gives me chills to get into, you know, what makes a good story work.
Mm.
You know, the themes of that your previous guest was talking about, you know, have to be worked, and they have to be fit into a story in a certain way. So the study of that and how that works is just never ending, and that's why I love what I'm doing now. These books have been a remarkable transformation for me. I keep selling scripts. I sold a horror movie last year, as a matter of fact. It's like my 13th spec script.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, yeah, thanks. But the most fun I'm having now is talking to other writers and helping them with their scripts and getting some of these points across. I think it's a very important part of communication, and telling a good story, you know, can be mastered and used in any situation, you know, a speech you give or commercial for something, anything. We tell stories.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And they can purchase your book on Amazon.com and also communicate with you and purchase your book through your own personal website.
Yes, and also in both the books I give out my personal email address, which is bsnyder264@aol.com, and I welcome people to, you know, pitch me their movie idea, ask advice of anything. You know, I'm happy to help them navigate these waters, and whether they want to make an independent film or a doc or, you know, break into the studio system in some sense, happy to help.
Well, that's wonderful.
I'm so sorry we're running over, but I can't let you leave without asking you about your take on the impending writer's strike.
Mm.
You know, this has been making headlines lately, and what's your take on this? Do you think it'll settle before a strike occurs? Or?
Well, you know, I was around for the 88 strike. I actually walked the line.
Yeah.
And it's good for writers because, you know, we're usually in our rooms. We don't get out much. And it's the only time I ever got to see any other writers. Oh, hey, how are you? Oh, yeah, good to see you. You know, you get your call from your strike captain, and, you know, depending on where you are, you know, some of the more well-to-do writers have their chauffeurs drive them down to the strike zone.
Right.
But the last strike was sort of unsatisfactory for everybody, I felt, and I hear varying opinions. I had a meeting or a get-together at Terry Rossio's house the other night with a bunch of screenwriters together, mm-hmm. and convinced that it was going to go through, convinced that there was going to be a long strike. But again, for me...
A long strike?
Yeah, that's what
oh, my.
Heard.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah. And it's you don't realize, you know, but it impacts the entire city and everything about, you know, lots and lots of people are affected by it.
Yeah.
So I hope it gets resolved, and the only good thing about a strike for a writer is it's a great time to sit down and write a script. I mean, you can write on your own on spec. You know, you can't be hired to write or work for a producer or anything, but in your spare time, you know, a lot of spec scripts were written during the 88 strike, and it led to, you know,
some of the big
movies that came out and were sold afterwards. So
That's right. Which one did you find more difficult and challenging? Is it writing a screenplay or writing a book?
definitely writing a screenplay. The books I've just discovered how much I love talking about film, and these are just a joy, just a pleasure. And watching films and finding the patterns in these films and helping people has been really, really meaningful to me. It's just put a whole new take on my career, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
Well, I certainly thank you for writing this book, and I thank you for joining us tonight. And I'm so sorry we're so rushed.
Yeah, you have to come back.
Oh, please. I'd love to.
You
Thanks.
Have
you guys
to come
are terrific.
Back. This has been great, and we have a lot we want to talk to you about.
Thanks, and if you have a screenplay idea, just email me.
This is a first. I got to say to you, this is a first. I have never I've taken a lot of screenwriting seminars. I've taken Robert McKay's seminar, and he was usually like, if you have a screenplay idea, I don't want to hear it. But you, my friend, have been just a joy, and that's great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Snyder, and please come back sometime in the future.
Anytime. Love your show. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have
thank
a good
you,
night.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Bye. Bye-bye. That is Mr. Blake Snyder, his new book, and I seriously recommend, you know, even if you're not a screenwriter, this is a must-read book because, like I said in the intro, you appreciate films in a whole new light. They don't become any less magical by knowing how they work, but it just enriches the whole viewing experience of these classic films. And you start to notice the patterns in new films that you watch. It's an extraordinary book.
Yeah, and his website is on blakesnyder.com, and I suggest everyone go over there.
And you can correspond with him if you have any questions. If you're a screenwriter, then he's certainly very accommodating. Save the Cat goes to the movies, the screenwriter's guide to every story ever told, and it really is something. Please pick that book up. All right, next Wednesday night, Brian De Palma, get ready.
That's all you need to know. That's all you need to know next Wednesday. Brian De Palma, redacted. It's going to be awesome.
We thank everyone for joining us in the chat room, and quite a few people showed up on the chat room here, and we thank all of our loyal listeners. We couldn't do this without you guys.
That's right. You make it all possible.
Thank you guys so much. We will see you on Sunday night, where we'll be talking about marketing and distribution.
All right. Sweet. Good night, everybody.
Good night, guys. Bye-bye.